It was clear that her family had had their hopes raised falsely. Photodynamic therapy had been shown some time ago to be of little use, and I was angry that it had been suggested. It seemed unlikely, however, that her family would accept that nothing further could be done, and I knew they would want anything done, even if it only added a few weeks to her life. With little enthusiasm, I telephoned my registrar and asked him to arrange for the patient to be transferred to our hospital. Over the course of the day, into the evening, I received a series of phone calls and text messages about the patient and the seemingly insuperable problems of transferring her from one hospital to another. Helen was said to be unconscious and would now need to be transferred on a ventilator and would therefore need an ITU bed on arrival. We had no ITU beds. I suggested the local doctors try their neighbouring neurosurgical unit, though I knew that my colleagues there would not be impressed by my plan of operating on such a hopeless case. But then, I told myself, they did not know the family. And then I was told she was better and no longer need an ITU bed. I then rang my registrar, who said that we had ward beds and that we would be able to admit her. At 10 o'clock in the evening, the hospital in Lincolnshire rang me to say that they had been told by my hospital's bed manager that we did not have any beds. In a state of increasing irritation, I drove there myself to find a bed and the nurse in charge of admissions. I found her, a highly competent nurse, with whom I have worked for years by the nurses' station. "Why can't we admit the patient from Lincolnshire?" I asked. "I'm sorry, Mr. Marsh. We are waiting for the London ambulance to collect another patient, and we cannot accept the new patient until the bed is empty," she replied. "But she's coming from over 100 miles away," I said, almost shouting. "She'll arrive in the middle of the bloody night if you insist on waiting for the ambulance to collect the other patient first." The nurse looked anxiously at me, and I worried she was going to burst into tears. "Look, just tell them to send her," I said, struggling to speak more gently. "If there are problems, say it's all my fault and that I insisted." She nodded her head and said nothing, obviously unhappy about my asking her to break some management protocol about how to admit patients. I felt unable to ask her what she was going to do, reluctant to upset her any further. I turned away and went home. In the past, this would never have happened. An extra bed would always have been found, nor would anybody have questioned my instructions. Helen finally arrived in the middle of the night, though when I went into work in the morning, nobody knew to which ward she had been admitted, and I went to the morning meeting without having seen her. At the meeting, I told the on-call registrar to put the patient's brain scan up. I gave a brief summary of Helen's history. "Why do you think I am operating on this hopeless case?" I asked the juniors. No one volunteered a reply. So I explained about her family and how they found it impossible to accept that nothing more could be done. With slowly progressive cancers, it can be very difficult to know when to stop. The patients and their families become unrealistic and start to think that they can go on being treated forever, that the end will never come, that death can be forever postponed. They cling to life. I told the meeting about a similar problem some years ago of a 3-year-old child, an only child from IVF treatment. I had operated for a malignant ependymoma, and he was fine, and had radiotherapy afterwards. When it recurred, which ependymomas always do, 2 years later, I operated again, and it recurred again, deep in the brain, soon afterwards. I refused to operate another time. It seemed pointless. The conversation with his parents was terrible. They wouldn't accept what I said, and they found a neurosurgeon elsewhere who operated 3 times over the next year, and the boy still died. His parents then tried to sue me for negligence. It was one of the reasons I stopped doing pediatrics. Love, I reminded my trainees, can be very selfish. Is that why you're operating on this case? Worried that you might be sued? Somebody asked. In fact, I was not worried about being sued, but I was worried that I was being a coward, or maybe just lazy. Perhaps I was going to operate because I couldn't face confronting the family and telling them it was time for Helen to die. Besides, the cancer specialists think it's a big success if the latest expensive new drug keeps a patient alive for an extra few months. What's the photodynamic therapy? Somebody else asked. Shining laser light on the tumour, my colleague Francis explained. It only penetrates 1 millimetre and has been shown to be pretty useless. To recommend it now is highly dubious. I think you're daft, he added, looking at me. This'll be her fourth op. She's had radiotherapy. The tumour will grow back within weeks. She's at high risk of the bone flap getting infected, and then you'll have to remove it and leave her with a big hole under her scalp, and she'll die slowly and miserably with a fungus. I couldn't deny that this might happen. I turned to the row of registrars sitting at the back of the room and asked if any of them had seen a fungus cerebri. It seemed nobody had, and I hoped that none of them ever would. I have only seen it once, and that was in Ukraine. If you've had to take the bone flap out after operating on a malignant tumour because the flap's got infected and you don't replace it, the patient will then die slowly as the tumour recurs, since the tumour can expand outwards through the defect in the skull under the scalp. The patient looks like a Star Trek alien with an extra bit of brain. You don't die quickly from raised intracranial pressure as you do when the skull is intact. Can't you put a metal plate back in? One of the juniors asked. It'll probably just get infected in turn, I said. If the bone flap gets infected, why don't you just leave it in? He asked. And have pus pouring out of the patient's head? Maybe if the patient was at home, but you can't very well leave an open infection on a hospital ward, Francis said. Well, I hope you get away with it, but I still think you're daft. Just say no. I operated later that morning. I found a sad tangle of tumour, dying brain and blood vessels, and could achieve next to nothing. As I assisted my registrar stitching Helen's fragile scalp back together, I bitterly regretted my weakness in agreeing to operate. These thoughts were interrupted by the anaesthetist. "One of the managers was round here earlier," he said. She was very angry that you were admitting patients when there wasn't a bed and said you shouldn't be operating on this case anyway. That's none of her bloody business, I growled. I make the clinical decisions here. She doesn't. Maybe she would like to go and talk to the family and tell them it's time for Helen to die or that we haven't got any beds. My hands were starting to shake with anger, and I had to make a conscious effort to calm down and get on with the operation. When her scalp was closed, my registrar and I stood back and looked at the girl's head. "It's not going to heal very well, is it?" he commented, young enough still to enjoy the drama and tragedy of medicine. "You haven't seen a fungus," I replied. Afterwards, I sat down with the family in one of the little rooms off the ward dedicated to breaking bad news. I did my best to deprive them of all hope, which rather contradicted any reason for operating in the first place, so I was not pleased with myself. I told them that I didn't think the operation was going to make any useful difference, and it was only a matter of time before Helen died. "I know you feel unhappy about operating again," her brother said to me after I'd finished. "But we want you to know how grateful we are. None of the other doctors would listen to us. She knows she's going to die. She just wants a little longer, that's all." As he spoke, I could see that it was a fine spring morning, and even the dull hospital courtyard outside seemed a little hopeful. "Well, If we're lucky, she might get a few extra months, I said, trying to soften the blow, already regretting how I had spoken to them a few minutes earlier, failing to find a balance between hope and reality. I left them in the little room, their knees squeezed together, as the four of them sat on the small sofa and wondered, yet again, as I walked away down the dark hospital corridor, at the way we cling so tightly to life, and how there would be so much less suffering if we did not. Life without hope is hopelessly difficult, but at the end, hope can so easily make fools of us all.